Good afternoon. Welcome to Lectionary at Lunch at Concordia Seminary. I'm Professor Tom Egger, and we'll be looking at the RCL reading for Lent 4 from the Old Testament, Joshua 5, 9 through 12. This is an interesting pericope, especially matched alongside the gospel reading from Luke 15, I think. It's short, just verses 9 through 12, so we can take a close look at the Hebrew, and also, though we'll want to read it in its broader context in the narrative of Joshua, since we're only dealing with four verses here, we'll have to ask the question how they fit in with both the story that lies behind the text and also the story that is still to come. Why don't we begin just by jumping right into verse 9, and it will raise the question of previous context. So, verse 9, Vayomer Yahweh El Yehoshua, Hayom Galoti et Kerpat Mitzrayim, Me Alekem. Vayikra Shem Hamakom Hahu Gilgal Ad Hayom Hatzeh. All right, the Vav consecutive continues the previous narrative. We've had the story in Joshua, of course, of entering into the promised land. Moses has died at the end of the Pentateuch. Joshua now has Moses' prophetic mantle and is leading the people, pointing them back to the Torah of Moses, but also pointing them ahead to the inheritance that God has ahead of them now in this new land. They have crossed the Jordan River on dry land, just as the Israelites before went through the Red Sea on dry land, and they have entered into the area near Jericho and are preparing for the conquest. But before they do so, God commands Joshua to make flint knives here early in chapter 5 and to circumcise all those who had not been circumcised in the wilderness, which were most of the people who were born in the wilderness, apparently, had not been circumcised. We aren't given a clear idea of why that is, but they've been circumcised now, and God's words here refer back to this circumcision of the people. And Yahweh said, Vayomer Yahweh, to Joshua, Hayom, today, referring back to this event that's just happened, the circumcision. Yom with the direct object ha oftentimes has the sense of this day or today. Galoti, I have rolled back. This is an interesting verb form. The root verb here is the geminate galal. And if you'll recall, these geminate verbs before their personal ending get a helping holem, which is why the form there is galoti. I have rolled back this very day, direct object, cherpa is reproach or shame, and it's in construct with Egypt. I have rolled back this day the reproach of Egypt from upon you. Now, there's some question what this means, the reproach of Egypt, and the commentators discuss this at some length usually. The question in my mind here that makes this a little bit difficult is whether the today refers specifically to the circumcision that God has provided for the people, so that in being circumcised, now he's rolled back the reproach of Egypt, or is it because he's now brought them into the land and they are decisively now entering into the land. This day he has rolled back the reproach of Egypt by now bringing them into the land. Or is it a combination of the two? And so reproach of Egypt, does it refer to the fact that the Egyptians had been reviling them all this time because they were stuck out in the wilderness? Or does it refer specifically to their uncircumcised state in the wilderness, that like the Egyptians, they were uncircumcised in the wilderness all these years. Either way, this theme of God removing the disgrace of his people, rolling back their reproach, is certainly a gospel promise and a gospel declaration, and it's tied with both their entry into the land and to this gift of circumcision. So Yahweh says to Joshua, "Today I have rolled back the reproach of Egypt from upon you. Vayikra shame, and he called the name of Makom Hahu, the name of that place, Gilgal." And you can see that Gilgal is derived from the root galal, rolling, or rolling back, rolling away. This construction here, vayikra, from the verb kara, to call or to name, oftentimes, especially when you have the noun name right after it, could either be assuming Joshua as the subject. Joshua called the name of that place Gilgal. Or oftentimes, kara is used in these kinds of constructions in an impersonal sense. He called, or one called, the name of that place. In English, we would probably make that a passive. The name of that place was called Gilgal, or is called Gilgal, ad hayom hazeh, until this day. And those little tag phrases, until this day, are common in the book of Joshua and give us the perspective that this account is being recorded sometime later, looking back on previous events and noting that some of these names and places or memorials or monuments that are spoken of in the book of Joshua are still in place down to this day. Verse 10, Vayakanu b'nei Yisrael ba'Gilgal, Vayasu et ha-Pesach. And the sons of Israel camped. This is the verb kana at the beginning here. Again, the vav consecutive continues the main storyline. The third hey on kana has dropped off on this form. And the sons of Israel camped at Gilgal, and they did the Passover. Probably we wouldn't say in English they did the Passover from the verb asa here. Rather, they celebrated or observed the Passover. The relationship between these first two clauses is probably worth commenting on. That first vav consecutive phrase, "and they camped," is the sons of Israel did, at Gilgal, probably is not sequential with the previous statements, but instead should probably be read with the following clause, "and they celebrated the Passover," as kind of a temporal clause. So it's not marked in any special way in that regard, but oftentimes Hebrew will have more complex clause relationships than simply the forms of the language would indicate. So it's just a simple vav consecutive imperfect, but it can be read sort of as a subordinate clause to the clause that follows. So you might say, while Israel was camped at Gilgal. And the reason why we would read it that way is because it really isn't a separate action from, or an action that follows on the preceding. They've been camped at this place all along. It's just resuming that situation and then giving us the next concrete action. While they were camped at Gilgal, they celebrated the Pesach, the Passover. The second half of verse 10 then gives us a temporal clause. Ba'arba'a asar yom lachodesh ba'erev ba'arvot yeriko. The temporal bait there is followed by the number 4, arva'a, and then the number 10, asar, and then the noun yom. The 4-10 day, which is the Hebrew way of expressing the number 14, on the 14th day belonging to the month. So this was the day that God has commanded them to celebrate the Passover. Of course, they celebrated the Passover the first time on the night of the death of the firstborn in Egypt. They celebrated it a year later, we are told, in Numbers 9, while they were still camped at Sinai before setting off on their journey. And then the rest of the Pentateuch is silent on whether they have celebrated this during the years in the wilderness. Perhaps not. So this is probably a renewal of this this great institution commanded by God now that they are in the land. And if you'll recall, back in Exodus, even when God is first giving the instructions for the celebration of the Passover, there's a strong emphasis on when you come into the land. When you come into the land, observe this this celebration, this memorial. And in the land, you will have sons who have not seen the great things that God did for Egypt. So celebrate it in their midst and recount for them all the things that God has done. So as they reach the land here now, one of the first things that they do after being circumcised is to celebrate the Passover. God also commands that no one who is uncircumcised is to eat of the Passover. So the circumcision which has preceded is necessary for their participation in the Pesach. So they eat it on the 14th day belonging to the month, Ba'erev, in the evening, just as God commanded, Ba'arvot Yeriko, on the Arava, on the plains, this central plain that goes down through the Jordan Valley to the west of the Jordan. The this plain, the Arava, is called the Plains of Jericho, and on the east side of the Jordan River, this Arava region is called the Plains of Moab. And they've moved now in crossing the river from the Plains of Moab to the Plains of Jericho. But this is more than just an offhand statement at the end here. They are celebrating this Passover on the plains of Jericho, which certainly points forward in the narrative to the challenges that lie ahead of them, the great struggle and warfare which is yet to come. Here they are celebrating this great feast of joy and deliverance and confidence and peace, yet they're celebrating at the very doorstep of their first great foe, on this side of the Jordan River. All right, verse 11. Another Vav consecutive, the main storyline continues, by Yokalu me Avur Haaretz mi Makarat HaPesek Matzot v'Kalui. All right, and they ate, from the verb akal, they ate from the Avur of the land. From the Avur of the land. Avur is usually encountered in the Hebrew text with a preposition bait in front of it with the sense of on account of or for the sake of. But this is a much less common use of Avur, probably a different Avur, and it has the meaning fruit or produce, so or yield. So here they are eating from the yield of the land. They ate from the yield of the land, a partitive min there. Mi makarat ha-pesek. Makarat is a noun which is closely related to the noun, or actually, I guess, adverb makar, tomorrow. And it has a similar sense, on the morrow, or the next day, or the day after. It can mean when it's in construct with a noun like Pesach here. In Leviticus, oftentimes it will speak about mi makarat ha-shabbat, on the day after the Sabbath. Here it's the day after the Passover. So they ate from the fruit of the land on the day after the Passover. Matzot v'kalu. Matzot is the plural of matzah, unleavened bread. So in the plural, perhaps you would say unleavened bread cakes or unleavened bread loaves. Maybe unleavened bread doesn't come in loaves, I'm not sure. So they ate bakings of unleavened bread and kalu. This second noun here, which is further describing what they ate, is actually a call passive participle from the verb kala, which means to roast. And it implies something that's roasted, probably grain. It's usually used in the sense of roasted grain. So they ate from the fruit of the land the day after the Passover, unleavened bread and roasted grain. Remember God's promise that when they came into the land, they would eat from fruit of the land that they had not labored for. They'd live in houses they hadn't built, drink from wells that they hadn't dug. And here they are eating, just having crossed the Jordan River, mature grain. And so obviously this is from fields that they hadn't planted. Perhaps the residents of the land surrounding Jericho had fled into the safety of the walled city and left the fruit of the land now for the Israelites. The unleavened bread they are eating beginning this day after Passover as part of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which lasts for 7 days beginning with this Passover. And notice then the last few words of verse 11, Be'etzem hayom hazeh, in the bone of the day, the that one. This is an idiomatic expression. Etzem here does not literally mean bone, but is in the sense of kind of the core or the very thing. So here temporally, we would say in English, on that very day or on this very day. The sense then is that this Passover coming into the land is a momentous occasion. It's a turning point. It is the point at which they really inherit the land. And the last time this construction from the day after the Passover or on the day after the Passover was used, it was used in the Pentateuch to refer to Israel leaving Egypt, departing from Egypt. The day after the Passover, they depart. They go forth from Egypt. And now we have them on the day after this Passover inheriting decisively the land. God is now initiating the giving, the fulfilling of the promise on this very day. Something else significant happens then as a turning point, and that's specified here in verse 12. Vayishbot Haman me'makarat ba'aklam me'avur ha'aretz velo haya od livnei Yisrael man. Let's stop there in the middle of the verse. And the manna, ha-man, notice in Hebrew, manna is simply man. It shabbats, or it shabbated in the narrative. Vav consecutive imperfect here. This is shabbat as in Sabbath, but it's the verb form. It ceased. The manna ceased from the day after. Now, if you'll notice here, mi'makarat is the very same word as in verse 11, mi'makarat, with the exception of the final vowel. Here it's a kametz, which indicates its absolute form. In verse 11, it was a patak before the final tav, indicating that it was in construct with ha-pesach. So here we read it as, instead of describing the day after the Passover, it simply stands on its own. And the manna ceased the next day, or you might say that next day, referring back to the day after the Passover. They're now eating on that day from the produce of the land, the roasted grain and the unleavened bread cakes made from the produce of the land. And so now the manna, which has sustained them all through the wilderness, ceases. The manna ceased on that next day. And now we have a temporal bait before an infinitive construct from akal with an am ending, a third masculine plural ending. When they ate, at the time of their eating. The manna ceased on that next day. At the time of their eating from, again, avur, the fruit or the produce, from the produce of the land, velo haya od, and there was not od any longer, livnei Yisrael, for the sons of Israel, man, manna. And notice the atnak there that breaks the verse in half. And there was no longer manna for the sons of Israel. So the manna stops here in a decisive way because God is now, having miraculously fed them in the wilderness with this bread of angels, the heavenly manna, He now will sustain them in this new land through the means of the bounty of that land. Vayokalu mitavuat eretz kanaan bashana hahi. And they ate from the tavuat, or tavuah is its absolute form. Notice this is a noun formed from the root bo, to come. This is the stuff that comes from, the stuff that comes of the land, really just a synonym with avur, above. Tevuah means yield or produce. And they ate from the yield of the land of Canaan in that year, in the year that one. Again, this emphasis on this decisive moment and turning point for God's people. Well, there are a number of things to note in this passage. Let me just note very briefly four points. First of all, I think it's interesting to note the emphasis on this time language and of the perfect provision and planning of Yahweh. Everything works out according to his plan. Back in the Pentateuch, he leads them out of Egypt. He leads them to himself at Sinai, and exactly 1 year later, they erect the tabernacle and celebrate the Passover again. And now here they are, finally, after a time of great trial and suffering in the wilderness because of their disobedience, but also a time of provision and care, they now come into the land of promise at the perfect time. And just in time to celebrate in the month of Abib, although it doesn't specify that in the text, it's implied, on the 14th day of the month, the Passover of God. And at that very moment, from that day on, there's this transition from his special provision of food in the wilderness to his more natural, you might say, or through secondary means, provision of food through the gift of the land. A second thing to note is the emphasis in verse 9 on this turning away of the reproach of Egypt from upon them, a God who changes the reproach of his people. Whether this comes from their bondage or from the murmuring and a ridicule of Egypt because of their time in the desert, which was a result of their disobedience, or whether it refers to their uncircumcision, which perhaps was a sign of their bearing of their disobedience in the wilderness, the way that they had put in jeopardy their relationship with Yahweh. Whatever was the cause of their reproach, it had its roots in they themselves, and its removal is purely a gift of God's grace. God commands Joshua to make flint knives and gives the people the gift of circumcision, brings them into the land, and he is the one who lifts their reproach. He is the agent of the verb galal, who rolls away the reproach of Egypt that was upon them. The implications of this for preaching the gospel are rich in potential. The picture of Christ in the season of Lent as the one who first of all bears our reproach, and then, of course, who rolls it away through his suffering work, and all of the ways in which being grafted into the people of God, feasting under his provision, being heirs of his eternal inheritance, it does remove and roll away all of the reproach that we experience and frankly, that we deserve in so many ways here in this life. A third point to note, I think I alluded to this earlier, it's so significant that Jericho is mentioned in the middle of this Passover celebration. And again, in the following verses, when Joshua is going to meet the commander of the armies of the Lord, this angelic Christ figure in the narrative, it will again be emphasized that he is looking towards Jericho and that the story of Jericho is looming ahead here in the narrative. This Passover feast, then, a feast of great renewal and provision and recollection of God's saving acts in the past, is enjoyed here in the narrative in peace. We're told the people have melted, the people, the Canaanites, those hiding in the walls of Jericho have melted with fear. Their hearts have melted because of the things that God has done for the people, specifically drying up the waters of the Jordan. And so now they have this moment of respite, the Israelites do, where they can thoroughly enjoy this feast. This strikes me as a wonderful Eucharistic picture, also a wonderful picture of the Christian celebration of Easter here in this life. celebrations that take place, both the Eucharist and the festival of Easter, in the midst of a life that is full of struggles and hardships and battles for God's people, enemies all around. And yet there are these moments, gifts of God, the gift of the body and blood of Christ in the Eucharist, peace with God, the forgiveness of our sins, a foretaste of a coming land and victory. And all the same things could be said of our celebration of Easter. In fact, of course, the two are combined on Easter Sunday when we, in the celebration of Christ's resurrection, sit at his table as guests at his table. This is a wonderful picture of that here in the narrative of the Old Testament. God's people have come to the land. All of these struggles now lie behind them of the wilderness, and yet many struggles lie ahead. And at the bridge between these conflicts lies this wonderful gift of God's provision in the Passover feast. And finally, the last point that I wanted to mention is the relationship between this text and the gospel reading. It is not an immediately clear association in my mind, how Joshua 5, 9 through 12 was paired up with Luke 15, the parable of the prodigal son. But it is illuminating, I think, perhaps less to try to read the prodigal son in light of the Old Testament reading, as it is to reverse the two and to consider the way in which Jesus' parable of the prodigal son gives us an interesting slant on a way to frame the Joshua 5 episode here, that God's son, Israel, has wandered in the wilderness in great sorrow and difficulty now for some time, but here in this pericope comes home and enjoys the feasting of the Father's house, you might say, in the new land. First tastes of the fruit of Canaan, but not as strangers, but as those who belong in this land. This was the land promised to their fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, where the patriarchs dwelled. And now after their sojourn in Egypt, where they were in great hardship, and also their time of wandering in the wilderness, they have now been brought home amid great joy and a father's reception. Well, that's enough on Joshua 5. God's blessings to you as you preach this text and meditate on God's graciousness to his people here in Joshua 5.